Ted Chapin, you had a unique insight into Follies because you were there at the birth of it.
So I was. Actually, Dick Latessa, who was an actor in Follies, gave himself a lunch, sort of celebrating his years in the theater. And there were two of us from Follies in the room. And I explained that what I really had done was gotten my college to agree to let me observe. And what happened that was to my advantage was when I showed up as an observer, the show was over budget. And so they were in need of somebody to run errands and type scripts. And I was there. And it was much better for me because being the production assistant or gopher, I had a position in the company. So that I could not only do interesting things, type lyrics, type scripts, ferry manuscripts from Stephen Sondheim's house on 49th Street to the copyists and to the orchestrator, and much more interesting than just sitting in a rehearsal room looking and writing down. Mm. But it was clearly a show that became more dazzling than I probably even would have thought. Follies is in so many ways a quintessential Sondheim score because it does embrace the traditions of musical theater, and there are all those wonderful numbers that are homages or pastiches, as Steve likes to call them, to another era, to specific kinds of songs. And they're wonderful and they're fun, and some of them have become staples in the Sondheim songbook. But the idea of writing a story about a reunion of two people who deserved to be at this reunion, being the Follies girls, and the two men that are their husbands who have different reasons to be there. I mean, they are married to the two women, but they're stage door Johnnies, and they have their own reasons to confront what they had been at the time of the Follies. Given the whole potential spectrum of emotions that any human being is going to go through at a time like that, gave Sondheim opportunities to write songs of such character interest and emotional complexity. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think of The Road You Didn't Take. I mean, when the sophisticated Ben, who has had obviously very successful career as a diplomat, and he basically sings a song of regret, and the line that kills me every time I hear it is, "The Ben I'll never be, who remembers him?" Yes. I mean, that's so Sondheim, because the fact is, nobody remembers the Ben he'll never be because he'll never be that. You know, and it's just, it's one of those moments that Sondheim does better than anybody. If you hear words and they're beautifully put together and you think, it's so profound.
The road you never take go through rocky ground, don't they? The choices that you make aren't all that grim. The worlds you never see still will be around, won't they? The Ben I'll never be, who remembers him?
Steve always writes amazingly about love and about relationships. My favourite lyric of his entirely comes from Follies, and it is... all that time wasted, merely passing through. Time I could have spent, so content, wasting time with you. Doesn't that just, I mean, it's got everything.
It's okay to waste time
everything.
As long as it's with the right
person.
Oh,
but it's so beautiful.
Yes.
Perhaps this is rather indiscreet, but at one time Steve said, well, which one do you want to play? And I said I couldn't play the other part because I couldn't sit there while somebody else sang in Buddy's Eyes. It's hard to sing because it's so moving. It's so moving, and of course he's doing this lie about her life, and he's doing it to the most beautiful tune. I'm showing you how exquisite, how wonderful my life is with this beautiful tune, and I'm singing it so beautifully. And inside, it's absolute hell.
In Buddy's eyes, I'm young, I'm beautiful. In Buddy's eyes, I can't get older. I'm still the princess, still.
Bodies
are daddy's arms on my shoulder. I won't get older. Nothing dies, and all I ever dreamed I'd be.
Say enough about Sondheim, the composer, and you know the last phases of In Buddy's Eyes are melodically ravishing, poignant, unexpected. It's an apotheosis. I always can't quite believe the way that song ends.
I'm going to start with a plug for the 4-CD set that you haven't listened to yet. This wonderful 4-CD set that's just come out of Sondheim. And one of the lessons I learned from it was listening to three songs from West Side Story, two of which have lyrics that one expects Sondheim to have written, because they sort of sound like Sondheim songs, lyrics. And then there's the song Tonight, which is a song I have always loved. And in the context of listening to Sondheim's work, it was like a little light went off in my mind, and I thought, now I understand why he says what he says about West Side Story. Because the music of Tonight is the event, and the lyrics are rather generic. Their images are fine, but I just suddenly thought, these are not characters that inspired Sondheim. And then as you get very soon in this CD set to him as a composer, you realize what a major composer he is. And anybody who starts his career not composing has to, I guess, and in the case of Sondheim, get over a prejudice people have about how, oh, no, he did great lyrics for these two wonderful composers. Julie Stein and Leonard Bernstein are fabulous composers. But Sondheim is a major, major composer. Not only the subtleties and the emotion of songs like In Buddy's Eyes and how it floats into areas that you don't quite expect. Mm-hmm. And then you hear, you know, Joanna in Sweeney Todd, which is as big a melody as anybody ever wrote. And then you hear the funny songs, the songs where, and this frankly I think is something he learned from both Rodgers and Hammerstein, when the lyrics are the event of the song and the melody just has to stay out of the way. I mean, this CD set made me realize once again what a major composer he is.
Sure, why? I think there's something. I mean, the melancholy nature of it, and the sort of, you know, wistful longing for something that you kind of, you create it as you're describing it, and then it's gone again. But for the time that you're describing it, you're making it live again for yourself. And I guess maybe that, to me, kind of is in, you know, in a few minutes in song is kind of captures the act of making theater, you know, that you by describing it bring it into being, and then at the end of it it all disappears again.
As coat racks spread like broken umbrellas, and parks and bridges
for me, there is something about his work that is very humane in that he doesn't mind exposing us as people in through song, which is a particular, you know, form of release, but in all our glory and in all our crap. And that's why I think we go and see these things, because we get to recognize that, yeah, we have shadow sides, we have dark sides, and we have things that we don't want to admit we have, obsessions and needs, and we have a child in us that never really goes away, and you know, in our dark moments doesn't let us grow up.
Loving you is not a choice, it's who I am. Loving you is not a choice, and not much reason to rejoice, but it gives me purpose, gives me voice to say to the world, this is why I live. You are why I live.
I would love to play Vasca again. That's a role I would really love to revisit. And you know who hasn't been there? Take away the period, the location, and the ugliness. Who hasn't been there in that situation with someone you've desired? I suppose I've never felt beautiful. I've always felt rejected by men. You know, the guys that I liked went running. And the guys that asked me out where the guys would say, let me ask you a question. That's my favorite thing to say. Let me ask you a question. So there was a lot to relate to in that character. I'm an Italian. I understand that passion. I understand that. And you know what? The bottom line always with me is I am not responsible to anything, for anything but the text. And Steve wrote a very clear character who I believe she's on equal footing with this man. This is her soulmate, and she's just trying to convince him, you've got to see beyond the looks, the physicality, and understand that we are emotional soulmates. And it's clear in the scene when she summons him to the bedroom when they're talking about, you know, I can't remember the what they're talking about. I know she has him write the letter.
Yes.
That's the song I'm talking about. The letter that she writes, that
it's
he writes for her.
You,
oh,
you
but
think
it's stunning, because it's so true. It's so, that scene is the most romantic, beautiful scene. Mm. All I did was try to be in the ugliness, for lack of a better word, as desirous as possible, and as wounded as possible.
I wish that I could love you, for now I'm seeing love like none I've ever known. A love as pure, permanent as death, implacable as stone. A love that like a knife has cut into a life I wanted left alone.
Julie McKenzie, you were kind of baptized into the Sondheim circle with a show that we all recognized at the time, I think, as a real breakthrough show, and that was Company. You took over from Carol Richards when the American cast came to the Her Majesty's Theatre. Had you heard that show before then or seen it?
No, I hadn't heard it or seen it. I wasn't overly aware of Stephen at that time. But I found it the most fortunate occurrence probably in my life, in that I had to take over very early from Carol, who was sent back, was not well. And I had the wonderful good fortune to work with that American company. And you know, we Brits, we're we think giving up too much energy on things is probably, we're a little bit cool about that. But I learnt on the opening night, it was like being shot out of a cannon.
When you got the call to do it, Julia, did you rush out and buy the, because the album was out here at that time, because I remember a friend bringing it round to my place and saying,
yes,
I did. You've got to hear this.
Yes, well, of course I did, and I had very, very little time to take over. In fact, I only had one rehearsal with Larry Kurt for the big bedroom scene in Barcelona, and only about two rehearsals with the other girl singers in I'm driving a person crazy.
Yeah.
And I was singing middle line, and I don't ever sing middle line. I find it hard to hear the middle line. So it wasn't without its angst, I can say.
Barcelona. Let's talk about that song, because, yeah, I mean, that score is full of extraordinary things.
Barcelona, if you really break it down, it's got comedy timing to perfection. It's absolutely perfect.
What you thinking,
Barcelona?
Oh,
flight 18.
Stay a minute.
I would like to.
So,
don't be mean.
Stay a minute.
No, I can't.
Yes, you can.
No, I can't.
Where you going,
Barcelona?
So you said.
And Madrid.
Bon voyage.
On a Boeing.
Good night.
You're angry.
No.
I've got to.
Right.
Report to.
Go.
That's not to say that if I had my way. Oh, well, I guess.
What?
I'll stay.
But. Oh, God.
When you're performing Sondheim, well, for instance, when we did the review side by side by Sondheim, we always felt every night was like climbing the north face of the Eiger. He demands so much from you. And the concentration level is more than anything else you've ever done. And you can be off a minute bit and it doesn't work the same. It's absolute perfection. In fact, so many times I think, I wish I'd never met him, really. I wish I'd never worked with his stuff, because he makes everything else impossible to do.
Mm.
For me, he's the only person to interpret in music theatre.
Coming back to that number again, I mean, did you find from performance to performance that the timing obviously alters slightly? It has to, because it wouldn't be fresh otherwise.
Mm.
Did you find the slightest nuance affected the laughs you got and the kind of...
Oh, certainly, certainly. But comedy is like that, isn't it? It's so mercurial. And also I have to say, it's very different here than it is when we perform it in America. In England, although you're doing exactly the same stuff, you have to lay off just a little bit and show that it wasn't a funny thing, and then they'll laugh. But in America, you have to lay it in maybe just a little more and say, that was funny, wasn't it?
Mm.
But it's the same material, and I find with Steve's stuff, it's not a flexibility, but you can just inflect a little way this way and a little that way, and that's what gives you the pleasure.
And that's what he loves too, doesn't he? Because he loves seeing actors take hold of the material.
He does.
And make it their own.
If I can quote a little story. When we first did Side by Side by Sondheim, we did it in concerts up and down the country to see if it worked. And my goodness, by the interval of the first time we did it, even to a coach party of old ladies, we realised that for people who hadn't heard Sondheim before, this was a very, very special thing. And gradually we came nearer to London. Cameron bought it and put it in for 6 weeks at the Mermaid Theatre, which we thought, well, it won't go 6 weeks, but how lovely. Well, of course, it went years and years at Wyndham's and in New York. Terrific. My point for the story is that Steve came to some of the rehearsals before we went into the Mermaid, and I started to sing Broadway Baby at about half tempo and very, very quietly. and I'd done about eight bars, and he said, no, that doesn't go like that. That doesn't go like it's just Broadway, baby. And then Ned said, well, she's been doing quite well with this, Steve, this way. You know, oh, hell, what do I know? I just wrote it, you know. And, of course, in the evening, when it went in, he did pretty well, I have to say. He was thrilled that I'd found a different way to do it.
Yeah. I'm just a Broadway baby, walking off my tired feet, pounding 42nd Street to be at a show.
Cameron McIntosh, when did you first become aware of Steve Sondheim? Because we've all got stories about the first thing we heard, or...
Well, it must have been West Side Story, you know. I remember seeing that at Her Majesty's Theatre and just being completely blown away. It was one of the seminal theatrical experiences of my life. Yeah. And it was a brilliant musical play, as well as having extraordinary staging. And it was unlike anything any of us had ever seen. And of course, you know, I recognise those brilliant words as being a huge part of the street language that made the thing so real. And then, of course, I started to follow, as I was mad keen about everything musical, his career through... I mean, funny thing with the great Frankie Howard of the Casey Gang, which was a marvellous show, and the on-off of Little Night Music, which was about to come on, and it didn't happen. And actually, it was that production that was my bridge into meeting Stephen, both as an artist and the beginning of a very, very long friendship, which has now gone on for over 35 years.
Yeah.
And Ned Sherrin, who I also knew purely personally, and he'd been very kind to me, he rang me up one day and said, Cameron, we've been working on this little show and we'd like to try it out in Brighton on your tour of John, Paul, George and Ringo. And, you know, do come along. And, you know, I was a very impoverished producer at that time, even though I'd put on a few West End shows which were, as Alan J. Lerner called them, success d'estimes, i.e. successes that ran out of steam and hadn't made any money back. And... I had booked my first Apex Fair to New York. I'd never been to New York, and I'd wanted to go to Broadway and see a Broadway show. You know, I mean, I'd seen a Broadway company in Company,
yeah.
When Company
yeah.
came over to Her Majesty's, but I had never seen a complete Broadway show on Broadway. So I had booked on that Saturday night to go and see Chicago, which my friends had said was okay, but it wasn't a patch on Cabaret and wouldn't run very long, which it didn't the first time round.
Exactly.
So I went, oh, well, I can't come. So I sent one of my old backers, who was called the Honourable George Borrock, of Borrock's Baking Powder, and one Christopher Biggins, said, you go and see it and ring me up in New York. So that night I went to see Chicago, and I thought, it's fantastic. This is a Broadway flop. Mm. I mean, it's the most amazing show. So I'd come back, and then I got this call from two very drunk people who were having had the most marvellous. It's marvellous, it's marvellous. They said, you've got to do it. And I said, describe it to me. And they said, it's four people, two grand pianos, and four stools. I'll do it. I said,
wow.
I'll do it.
Smart move.
And I thought instantly, Stephen Sondheim, the worst it can do is get me very good reviews and not make any money, and it doesn't sound like I could lose a lot of money. So I mentioned it to Arthur Kantor, who said, Sondheim, he'll close in preview. And I went, well, no, I still want to do it. And he said, well, if you really do, my new managing director has just taken over, who's a woman, you'll like her, Helen Montague, she's great fun. And indeed, I did love Helen Montague, the great, late lamented Helen Montague. And I went to see her when I came back. I took her the tape of the show, which was an amazing evening. I put it on, and it was just a show tape from the desk. And so, you know, the enthusiasm, the wit, the brio of the performance was extraordinary. Fourth track in, the number stopped the show, and Helen went, "Darling, it's wonderful, it's wonderful." And let's go to dinner, she said. I said, but we haven't heard it. But listen to the applause. I said, but don't you want to hear the rest of it? No, darling, she said, I'm tone deaf. You look after the show.
Working for a nice man like a second.
with Side by Side, I mean, were you the four of you surprised at the success? Because it was a review, basically, wasn't it? And that
we were, because it was, you know, three people, a narrator and two pianos. Yeah. And, of course, it's perfect, because you can really hear the stuff. There's no great lighting changes, no great scenery going on and off. Not the book. We just did the best of his stuff to that time, that he'd written to that time. And, it was mesmerising to do. Exhausting, absolutely exhausting.
Let's talk about Sally Plummer in Follies, which was 1987 in the West End, with some quite significant rewrites in the show.
Yes.
And a very changed ending, which I'm not convinced.
No, I think I'm with you. I think I'm with you.
Yeah, I think the darker ending.
Yes, and to take out The Road You Didn't Take was, I think, a crime. You know, it was the motif for all four leading characters, and it was a great shame to take that out.
Now, we've talked about Steve creating the timing and the dramatic situation for you in the way he writes songs. So what about Don't Look At Me, Sally's first entry?
But I mean, that's so brilliant, because she hasn't seen this man she's been in love with for, 30 years or something, and she's breathless with excitement. Doesn't know what to say, everything falls out. The breath groups, they don't look at me, please, not just yet. Why am I here? This is, it's perfect. You know, he gives you so much to play with, so much.
You would have liked him. Mama, you would. Mama, he makes things. Mama, they're good. Just as you said from the start, children and art. Children and art.
Maria Friedman, over the years, I've had the feeling that you've slowly but surely been turning into the Stephen Sondheim repertory company, the one-woman show. And rumour has it that you do occasionally sing other people's songs. But
as little as I can, yeah.
But it's been a very special relationship, hasn't it?
Mm.
And I believe it began when you sat in the Adelphi Theatre with your dad.
Yeah, I was 14 years old. Yeah, and my dad, Leonard Friedman, who was a very well-known violinist at the time, soloist, just sort of watched my little face as it was, you know, going from laughing to crying to, I just really couldn't believe how many things I could feel, you know, in the space of 10 minutes. He dug me really hard with his elbow. He said, "Now this is proper music. This is proper." And seeing as I was not able to do anything really at school or anywhere else, I thought, but I really felt a connection. I thought I could do this. This is something I could do. My dad would think it was really worthwhile.
Mm.
So it sort of, it ticked all the boxes. It was, yeah.
It sort of dawned on me when I first started seeing his shows that here was someone that really united music and drama in a way that musicals hadn't done for me before.
Yeah, and actually very rarely do still for me, you know.
Was Sunday in the Park with George the first show you actually did of his?
It was the first show I did of his. I'd done various concerts where I was singing his work, which was the first show, and I'm still as in love with it today. I mean, it is like a love affair. When you're playing one of his parts, it is a love affair.
I was watching a documentary the other day, the Omnibus BBC documentary about the making of Sunday in the Park with George at the National, watching Steve at work with you and what his priorities were. And what do you remember of the experience? Of course, it was the late Stephen Bimlott, wasn't it, who directed?
I'm not going to pretend it was an incredibly traumatic experience for all sorts of reasons. But what you're left with, of course, after the detail of the particular production and the particular director and whatever the problems were, you're left with this piece, you know, which permeates into your marrow of your being. And what I remember is, for the first time in my, I don't know how old I was, 27 or something, somebody didn't mind me being as exacting as I am. They weren't intimidated by my questioning. They were excited by my questioning and
he was so specific about what he wanted, and there is a story I remember. He came in and he gave us all notes, and I didn't take a pen and paper, and a lot were coming my way, and I was just absorbing them. And then he watched that particular preview, and the next note session he said he was ready to really go for me because I hadn't had a pen and paper, and he was so cross that I was going to have forgotten it all, but I remembered every single note. Now, that's not, I promise you, me saying, aren't I incredible? It's his notes. When somebody gives you, a note about a piece, if it makes sense, it just goes in, if you're on the right track. If it's not, you can't absorb it and you forget it. But all of his were absolutely bang on, and I was just nodding, listening. And as he was giving me the notes, I remember just sort of in my head being on the stage as that person at that time, and it all just thinking, oh yes, thank you, oh gosh, yes, oh my goodness, that makes sense. And then literally probably 21 notes later, I remember just sort of not even ticking them off as I was doing them, because they all just helped. They all just let me sail, and one connected to the note. Everything Steve does has a connection.
I actually wrote on the back of the picture, Steve Sondheim is yelling at me, Patti LuPone, in the event that this ever leaves my hands, which it won't. I'm very proud of that picture. But when we did Passion for that live at Lincoln Center, we had a little, not a lot of rehearsal. That was the one run through before the live performance the next night. And at the end of it, Steve made a beeline to me, and basically all I heard was monotony, mush. And it was 20 minutes of Steve yelling at me.
Boy.
And I asked everybody. I asked the musical director. I asked the director. I asked my co-stars or the other actors. And nobody actually understood what Steve meant, including Paul Gemignani. I said, can you not understand me? What's going on? Why did Steve say this to me? What is he trying to say to me? And the sound woman said, you know, you may be inaudible when you're emotional. And I went, thank you very much. This is an old acting problem of mine. They used to call me flannel mouth at Juilliard. So when I got emotional, I got articulate. And I think that's what Steve was trying to say to me, because, and that made sense. Mm. He was saying, be specific. And the next day, Steve came into the dressing room and said, difference of night and day.
I keep saying this, but it is a real honor working on this stuff, because they are great gifts of parts, and you long for those parts to come along, and they don't come along very often. So when you come, your gratitude is immense. I mean, some days you think, yeah, fuck gratitude. You know, I'm in this fucking theatre having to do this fucking show again. You know, but I have to say, on the whole, they are few and far between, those times.
Now, George, Sunday in the Park with George.
Yeah.
This. A great personal journey for you, as well as a great professional journey for you. A wonderful production, a wonderful performance. And again, you worked with Sondheim to some extent on the genesis of it.
Yes.
Technically, in this show, the hurdles are many and enormous.
Just singing-wise, they are.
Yeah.
Let alone the technical, nightmares that we had with our particular performance, which used digital technology and animation. But just on a singing level, it's a technical nightmare.
What are the real killers?
Well, first of all, the range. It was written, with Mandy Patinkin in mind, and Mandy was the original George and was an amazing George. And Mandy has this amazing range. This tenor, who is also a baritone, really, and that's where George, it's sort of, you have to be able to do this, one of the dogs in falsetto, then the other dog is very, very low in the voice, and then you get a little break, and then you have to do finishing the hat, which you have to belt G's and A flats, right at the top, where you've just been sort of doing, singing in your falsetto. So the throat is really going, what the fuck are you doing to me?
This is Sondheim's almost signature song, because it is about the obsessiveness of the creative process and the selfishness of the creative process as well.
Mm.
And it's about so many of those things that have never been voiced in song before.
No.
That's what's amazing about that number, isn't it?
And even in this song, it's sort of inarticulate. It's an attempt, I think, by an what's that word that Streisand uses, verklempt? Is that a word? That someone who maybe can't express their emotions very well, which George, of course, is, and has problems doing. So it's an attempt by that kind of person to put into words something that perhaps isn't possible to put into words.
That makes it twice as moving.
It does, because he's going, you know, for example, finishing the hat, ... how you have to finish the hat. It's hard to say what finishing the hat represents.
But the sense of achievement at the end of the song.
Yes.
I mean, in that one
line. Look, I made a hat where there never was a hat. Also, something that really speaks to me about it is the loneliness of the song and how lonely it is being an artist, especially maybe for a composer or a writer or a painter who works on their own. You know, he talks in the song about looking out of the window and observing the world and then having to come back to the hat. And I always think that must be a very lony place, you're not just physically removed from the world, but your head, in your mind, it's just you, you know.
Finishing the hat. How you have to finish the hat. How you watch the rest of the world from our window while you finish the hat. Mapping out a sky. What you feel like planning a sky. What you feel when voices that come through the window go until they distance and die. Until there's nothing but sky. And how you're always turning back too late from the grass or the stick or the dog or the light. How the kind of woman willing to wait's not the kind that you want to find waiting to return you to
the thing
night.
Is about Steve's characters, they are full of contradictions, which I don't know anyone alive that's interesting that isn't. And it's up to you to join the dots.
Yeah.
But it makes total sense that these are full, rounded, rich, you know, dynamic people.
I think any those of us that have ever done anything remotely creative relate to Sunday at the Park with George, because it nails the whole issue of how hard it is to be creative and how selfish it inevitably becomes, how absorbed one becomes and focused on it too.
Well, I mean, everyone will... This is, again, the great thing about Steve, is that he leaves things so open, it's really for us all to find our way. But for me, to have someone writing about that moment of white heat, that concentration where there is nothing but you and what you're doing, and the rest of the world just sort of evaporating. And anybody who's any good at anything, whether it's numbers or whether it's gardening or anything, there's that moment where there's just you and it, you and the work. There's more time, there's more space, there's more light. And I suppose it's, for me, that's what finishing the hat is about.
Look, I made a hat. Where there never was a hat.
Young people are attracted to stories. Maybe it's because in this world we live in, you know, you don't believe anything your politicians say. You know, you want to believe in something. And actually hearing voices of the street say something about what you feel is something that we all want. And seeing, I mean, I've seen, I couldn't believe how many young people now come to the theatre. It shows people are listening.
But it's
and
also
no one writes better lyrics in the world than Stephen Sondheim.
No. I've sat in these more intimate productions of Sondheim shows in recent years, and people have been hanging, as you say, on
every
word.
Absolutely. And
laughing at, you know, the subtlety and the wit of it.
I mean, look at, I mean, with the film with Sweeney Todd, which I thought a huge amount of it was terrific. And but, you know, people who'd never heard of Stephen Sondheim went to see it and thoroughly enjoyed it. They weren't attracted because it was Stephen Sondheim. They were obviously, it was Johnny Depp and the smell of that film, but there was something, they got it, even though they didn't know a word, they didn't know the songs, the tunes, they got into it.
you know, and it means that people's minds are completely open. That's the revolution that he's given us all, and he's always gone after, written what he believed in. And he's always gone, I know no one's going to want to come and see this, probably, but it's stretched.
He's not precious in any way whatsoever, but he knows why he's written everything. Every syllable will, you know, land on a note for a particular reason. And I don't mean that in a self-conscious sort of, you know, constrained way, but not saying anything anybody doesn't know, but he writes in speech patterns. So as long as you stay true to the meaning of what you're saying, your voice will land on the right notes at the right time. And if it is a quaver or a minim or a crotchet, whatever it is that he's written, will be, if it's longer, it will be because there's more yearning or more need to say something. And if it's a short note, it may be because you're thinking or you need a breath or you. And also, pauses are so important in Steve's work because they're thoughts. They're never just a break. It's always
give us an example of that.
Oh God, no, I can't. What's your hurry? You're not just doing something. You're actually actively thinking or making something, or, you know, I'm not being very clear, but if there is a gap, it will be because the character is looking for something to say, or it's too difficult to say, or they're physically doing something, you know, like suddenly be distracted. There's no point where he'll just put rest in because it sounds nice. You'll always be led by what's happening. And again, he's a collaborator, so he'll be working out what that dynamic is between that actor and yourself. And that actor may have just slammed a door and left, and then you're left. There'll be nothing to say. There'll be no music.
I think in all the work there's a great underlying yearning to feel almost at one with someone else, or maybe it's at one with oneself, but maybe that's, you know, a lifetime's journey. And for all of us, I'm getting very spiritual now for some reason, but I think that really does underpin the work. There's a yearning to be seen and recognized and appreciated, as whether it's as a human being, as an artist, as a dancer, as an assassin, you know, whatever it is. And I think I think that's, to me, what really connects with me.
Mm. I've come to a relationship quite late in life, and I'm about to cohabit with someone. And I keep thinking of that line, someone to ruin my sleep, because it's a fact.
Yes.
And all those lines.
And there's a sadomasochism to it. But there's a, you know, but yes, we yearn for it to just, yeah.
The line that completely does me in Sunday in the Park with George is, white a blank page, Kermit's his favourite, so many possibilities. Because I was certainly in my own life, you know, with my father, music was his favourite. And there were so many possibilities, and we all got left behind with his favourite. But at the same time, he made the most amazing music with his favourite and touched millions, thousands of people. So, you know, our loss, his gain.
The sun comes up, I think about you. The coffee cup.
I think one of the things about him is his constancy. Certainly in my relationship with him, it started slow. It built over the years that we did Gypsy, and then, of course, the journey Sweeney Todd. And in both of us growing older, shall we say, here he is celebrating his 80th year, and I celebrated his 79th year. You know, I was always involved with special concerts, and he's always been very, very grateful, I think, for friendship and having around him the people that he particularly has enjoyed working with, you know. And I think his friends are very, very few. Mm. And he's become much more gregarious as he's gotten older. He's come out of himself a lot. He's out, he's talking, he's wonderful with young people. He's teaching courses. I think that all of this has allowed him to blossom as a human being in ways that were not evident when I first knew him. He was much more enclosed and into himself and self-conscious to a point of being, you worried for him.
People always assume that people of stature and performers are very outgoing, but shyness is something that people forget.
And they do. They absolutely do. I think Steve is a very shy individual.
Mm.
And I think all his fame and everything hasn't helped him in respect to being less shy. He's even more shy in a sense. Mm. Not shy, but self-effacing in a way. He sort of pulls back, but not as much as he used to. But he said it himself. He said, "What is the hardest thing about success and growing old?" He said, "It's living up to other people's expectations of you."
Mm.
And I think that's something that I totally understand.
I think it's the combination of a kind of intelligence, a kind of intellectuality, a kind of fascination, and a kind of passion that is, by the true term of the word, unique. And those of us who grew up in the musical theater of the late 50s, early 60s, there was a lot of interesting musical theater being written in this country, but nothing had that combination of this all. I mean, it's the way Sondheim engages the mind and the heart together. And because the mind is so bright and so sharp and so clever and such a puzzle man, that at first the puzzle nature of his lyrics was so dazzling and I think fooled people into thinking that's where it started. And then as the career went on, you realize, no, it actually started in the heart, in the music, in the soul. And then the puzzle man never left. So that's in a large nutshell why I think this man is a genius.
With so little to be sure of, if there's anything at all, if there's anything at all, I'm sure of here and now, and us together. Anything to be, being sure enough of you makes me sure enough of me.
You know, the older you get and you look at the script that you've actually led and the script that you thought you were going to lead and how the two things don't relate at all, you know, that you suddenly, I remember saying once, when's my life going to start, and realising I was way over halfway through it, you know. That I think he doesn't have a great big moral message or anything, but it is about making sure that you take care of now, take care of it, take care of each other, and friendship being absolutely paramount. And
old friends.
And see, the thing that I feel that people don't understand about Steve, when, so arrogant, every single thing he writes is about love. Everything. They're all love songs. Love of life, love of friendship, need for love, wishing, wanting to be loved, finding it impossible to love. Everything is about that push to find what's available to all of us and almost impossible to keep and protect. Everything else is easy. Everything else is easy. Making money, not for everybody, but making money or pushing out a baby or anything, but actually loving and staying loving, which means that you kind of are really sowing your, you know, sowing the seeds that will flourish later on in your life. You know, how many people have the wisdom when they're in their 20s to recognize that actually what they're doing is chasing something which is shallow and hollow. And I think the majority of Steve's work is it doesn't dismiss ambition, and it doesn't negate that need to produce and be creative. But I don't believe that there's a single impulse that isn't written from love. Not one.
Everything we did, everything that's past, everything that's over too fast. None of it was wasted.
None of it was wasted.
All of it will last.
All of it will last.
Everything that's here.